father a supply I don't suppose my mother ever bought, in my knowing, a quilt or blankets or even clothing. Father would, they'd give it to father to bring anything that his family needed. So we were among the wealthy to father, and he paid him terrific wages, more than, he gave him $6 a day, government money, and he charged it up to whatever he wanted. So he gave him $6 a day for doing the butchering all the time they were here, over 3 years. So that father set father up in money. And he, after the army left, he took up sections of land here and there, and one up here, which he afterwards traded to the sugar company. In 1890, the sugar company couldn't get enough farmers to raise beets to run the factory, so father sold them his section of ground up on the, with plenty of water to it, from the creek, to raise beets for the sugar factory. And he took it in stock. He took the money. The company paid him well because he took it in stock. And so he was one of the wealthy of Lehi. And so everything worked out well for the sacrifices that he had made. Everything did well. His first wife lost her mind. She went completely insane. And so mother brought her up and gave her one section of the house to live in. And she took care of her. After all she'd suffered from her hand, she took care of that old woman. She lived. And when we, father built the new home, that's the home I live in now, she had everything in duplicate made. So we used to call the first wife Auntie, we kids did. So she was provided for, and she'd have her own apartments there, and mother would do all of her cooking, set her table, and she'd stay in to herself. But she never bothered anybody, only she just had lost her mind. She couldn't think. She was a kind old woman, and she loved my red hair. I've sat by her side, poor old soul, and she would stroke that hair until I used to wish, oh, I wish she'd quit, because I'd get so tired of sitting there, but I was afraid of offending the poor old soul. Mother had taught her to respect her as they did, as we did her, so there was no difference. As far as we children were concerned, we called her Auntie, and we were a happy family until she became bedfast and the boys got married off and I was left alone. And at that time, my poor old Auntie became bedfast. Mother took care of her for over 2 years, just like she would a baby. Even had to change her. And she loved that woman just as much as if she was a child. So when they say that polygamy was with the birds, it was, we never knew the difference between our mother and her.
Was polygamy legal then?
Yes. When I was 11 days old, do you know what happened? They passed the Edmund Tucker Law. And that was to penalize polygamy with prison sentences. So immediately, the non-Mormons here spied on all the Mormons here, and went to Provo and told the sheriff, who was a Gentile too. And he came over and arrested Father. Father went to Provo and we put him in the jail for 11 days. And, or 10 days it was, because I was a day old when they took him. And he was brought before the judge, and the judge says, how old is your youngest child, Mr. Hutchings? And he says, 11 days, sir. 1 year, case dismissed. That was the end of his trial. So I cost my father 1 year in prison. But while he was there, he didn't stop. He became, after he'd been there a week, he had supervision of all the prisoners there.
Did you call me?
No.
Oh, amen.
No. I maybe talked loud, I don't know. But he enjoyed, he really enjoyed, because so many of the polygamous men and the converts to the Mormon Church were men that couldn't even read or write. And they allowed him to teach. Not only the Mormons, but the Gentiles, they used to call them, the prisoners, to read and write to. So he'd done very well, and they were very, very good to Father. When he left the prison, there was even weeping among the prisoners. Not the Mormon, but the prisoners. One made a cane for Father. I'll show you the cane. It's made of horsehair. What's on your mind? Come and see that.
Well, I can look at it later. Why don't we just
well,
tape this
they
now?
Were very friendly to Father, and every thing that they could do by way of benefit, Father received it. And Mother would come up to see Father, and very few of the polygamous families, they wouldn't let any relative come by them. But when my mother would go out, she was treated as royalty. She could go and stay overnight if she wanted, in private cell, and treated just like royalty. So it didn't hurt Father a bit, and it didn't hurt the criminals that were there, because very few of them could read or write. And Father would teach them. So he had a mission there, and he felt like he was called there on a mission.
Could you tell me a little about the conditions in the prison? Were they kept with hardened criminals? Were the guards Gentiles?
Yes. They was hardened, but the man that was in there for murder was the man that made the horse hair walking stick for my father. He was a Negro. He'd killed a man in Eureka and put him there for life. But Father taught him to read and write too. And the trinkets they taught Father, the criminals could do what they wanted for so many hours a day. They had a big fence around, a big wall. It was a 12-foot wall. It was a hole this wide. I'd been on top of the wall myself, because they only tore that down about 20 years ago. The wall was around the fence.
Excuse me.
I guess my thinker isn't very well today. I lose track of what I'm... It's been so long since I've thought of that. It's all in my diaries, but I have a job keeping on one line of thought, because when I'm talking about one thing, another thing comes into my mind. I guess that's old age.
Would you tell me if the prisoners all stayed together, or how were the different prisoners treated, and were the guards
warned? Unless they were life prisoners and to solitary confinement, I think it was 4 hours a day they were allowed to be out in the yard and sun themselves. And Father didn't isolate himself from them. He felt like that he was called there on a mission. And he would teach them the gospel. And I'm sure that there's some that joined the church. They couldn't be baptized while they were in there. But he'd have his classes. So it didn't do him a bit of harm. It had done all of us good. Because when he left, Eunice.
That's okay. You don't need to ask her.
I was going to tell you the warden's name. When he retired, he lived in American Park.
That won't really be necessary.
Well, he was the warden anyhow. He was very good to Father and to give him all the privileges that he dare give him under the law. But Father would allow to anyone to wanted to. The convicts was supposed to be in one end. What was Doyle? Doyle, now I remember it, now you're here. Doyle was the warden. He finally, after retirement, he moved to American Park.
Was that not?
Yes. I couldn't think of Doyle. So.
Were all the prisoners treated the same?
No. No.
Could you explain that, please?
Well, where they weren't treated the same, it was their own fault. Father used to say that. He used to tell us children, never say that your father was a convict that was mistreated, because he wasn't. Father had all liberties and more liberties and means to that end was furnished him that a man could have had in his freedom. Because this particular man, you know, the father was just a little bit of Irish. Maybe you can tell that in me. That's where I got my red hair. But he never knew an enemy. I don't believe Father ever knew an enemy. Even when the mobs used to come in and raid Lehigh, trying to find the men, you know. They'd be led by a deputy sheriff, and there was lots of non-Mormons in Lehigh. They'd, to show their hatred for the Mormons, they'd join this, he'd round them up, and they'd come and surround a house, see if the man was in there, a polygamous wife. So that was the usual way. But when they, naturally, some of the polygamists had been mistreated, but it was their own faults. Our father was the man that gave him away, was a man by the name of Earl. He finally come and lived in Lehigh and joined the church. But he was the one that sent the Debs after, and he was became one of the wardens up there.
How did your mother get along? Now, you were 11 days old and your father was in prison, and she was bound to be weak from having children. How did she support y'all?
She had three boys old enough to irrigate. Now, the church didn't do one thing to help my mother. Bishop Evans, the reason he had a peeve, now this is confidential, I had not to go on the record. But my mother's youngest sister, one of the twins, the one that she'd brought across and fed with them on a little heifer calf that they brought with her, a cow. She brought her mother's twins that she was killed in Missouri. And the twins, she'd just given birth to these twins, a boy and a girl. And mother was 13 years old, but she rescued those out of the burning house and brought them to Utah and fed them. Her father, 8 days out of St. Louis, took a paralytic stroke. And she got that man into that wagon herself. And got him in there, and he never moved all the way across the plains. She had those two babies and him, and her 13 years old. And I'm going to tell you here, you don't need to go on the recorder because I want to put it that in her life. But the Indians, 8 days after they left St. Louis, is when her father took that stroke. And the next night, they were in a little hilly country. They were told in St. Louis to go until they hit the Platte River, then cross, and they'd hit the Mormon Trail in a few days after crossing the Platte. Well, they never crossed the Platte. They started west from St. Louis. They never saw a white person until they got the head of Emigration Canyon. And then they met a man going back as a freighter to freight to St. Louis, a young man. And she had that man, those babies, and an older brother, and that was just 12 years old, and his twin sister, besides those two babies. But she knew that she'd be taken care of. I tell you why. This first time she felt lonely was when they became getting to the healing country, just big sand hills, we'd call them. And they never come to the Platte River until they come to a stream of water, and they thought that was the Platte, and they went along, it was just a tributary to the Platte, but they went along that river going west. She followed the sun. Every morning she'd head toward the sun, and she'd stop when that sun went down so she wouldn't get lost. But this particular night, they'd such a beautiful day, she said, that they traveled until they just had time to unhitch the oxen and take care of the little cow that was tied at the back that she milked for the babies. And see, on top of one of those hills, it looked like a statue had been built. And it impressed her. It looked like a man on a horse, right on top of that knoll. And it was so far away, she couldn't make out, you know. And it was just the sun had gone down. But she kept watching that and watching it. I wonder what statue that could be. And finally, that statue moved and took a big spear, waved it back and forth. And in a very few minutes, the whole hill was covered with Indians on horses, hundreds of them. They give a big yelp, and away they come. And they circled her wagon. And she was cooking supper. She says she didn't know what to do, but she'd read in the Book of Mormon those people were Lamanites, the Indians. So she had no fear. So she just kept on cooking supper. And they got closer and closer, circling. Circling, circling, and the father was there in the back of the wagon, couldn't move. And the kiddies were out, the babies were in the back of the wagon with him. And when the Indians got right to them, the leader, the one that had the spear, jumped up and grabbed the wagon cover and ripped it off. He looked in there and saw the old man. He gave him a good shake, and he never even as much as batted an eye. He talked to the Indians a little bit. She couldn't tell what they're saying. Then he went over to her. Papa. She says, yes, that's my papa. Sick. She says, yes. Can't move. Can't move. Can't move. She shook the Indian. He can't move, you know. So he stood there and watched her a few minutes. He went and shook the old man. Shook him as hard as he could. He wasn't so much as battered an eye. You'll do. What did you want, Mother?
I wanted not to make a noise.
Well, you did well. We'll give you an A on that. Well, he shook it and he said something. The Indians had all surrounded the wagon, you know, just a close knit on their horses, all horses pointing in. And he said something, waved his, they all went. He got on his horse and went over and looked in the kettle. I don't know why, but he looked. He went. And just as it was about dark, here come two Indians back on their horses. One had four ducks. One had four rabbits. Cook. You know, this is the miracle. When they left St. Louis, they didn't know how far it was, no instructions, didn't know what. And already, in a few weeks out, they were out of provisions, all but flour. They had plenty of flour. But these Indians, every night, be met with 2 to 5 Indians with food, liquor, and they'd go. And sometimes the Indians would hide her cattle, her oxen and its cows. If there was any food at all, she would tie them out. When she'd get up in the morning, the rope would still be there, but the cattle gone. And the first time she was pretty worried. And she started to hunt them. It was just low rolling hills, the way she described it. Must have been the western part of Missouri, or in the first part of Kansas. Anyhow, there was these knolls. She called them big sand knolls. And she'd go up among them. And finally, following the tracks, she'd find all the cattle standing there together. The team and the cat, the cow and her calf standing in there together. Then the Indians come all together, surround her. She'd just start driving the cattle. And one of them usually would jump off. If the cattle would start to waver side to side, they'd jump off and the back. Never molested her, never touched her. But every night they were brought fresh meat. Even till they got to the foot of Immigration Canyon. And the Indians didn't.